May is Fibromyalgia Awareness Month. It's important to raise awareness about this chronic and often debilitating invisible illness known as fibromyalgia. This month-long campaign is an opportunity to educate people about the symptoms, causes, and treatments of fibromyalgia, as well as to show support for those living with these and other related invisible illnesses. Through increased awareness, we can work towards better understanding and management of fibromyalgia and ultimately improve the quality of life for those who are affected by it. And now on to this week's episode. ADHD is not just a children's issue. It affects adults and influences their lives in ways you might not realize. Join me on this second half of the interview with Mindy and Jeffrey Katz, who are experts in the field of ADHD. This is the Conquering Your Fibromyalgia podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Lenz. I am a pediatrician, an internal medicine doctor, a clinical lipidologist, and a lifestyle medicine physician who also is author of the book, Conquering Your Fibromyalgia, Real Answers and Real Solutions for Real Pain. The goal of the podcast is to go beyond just learning to live with, but to living better and even at times reversing fibromyalgia using a multifaceted approach, combining the best of lifestyle medicine and the best of medical management using an evidence-based approach. Remember that while I am a doctor, I am not your doctor. All of your signs and symptoms should be discussed with your own physician. And now on to this week's episode.
So I'm thinking about with your patients that they're already dealing with chronic pain, right? And I imagine they wouldn't want to be saddled with something else, but actually if it makes sense, it gives them some more understanding of their own illness, as well as what can be contributing to it or not helping it get better or to be able to manage it as well. I mean, I would think that would be important to them.
Study out of Japan looking at their patients who were evaluated using the diagnostic interview for adults known as the DIVA, as well as the adult self and observer, showed up to 70%. Interestingly, some of them were congruent, where both the spouse or partner and the patient agreed, and some were one noticed it and the others, because the symptoms may not be always recognized. And one of the frustrating things is that there can be an emotional and a mental exhaustion or fatigue, like you said, Mindy, sitting on a couch and looking on the outside, maybe by a spouse who's just like, oh, it's Saturday, we're recording this on a Saturday, and they're just not getting anything done. And one of the diagnostic criteria that for ADHD is having some kind of problem that it's causing. And I look at that as, to me, not accurate in the sense that, well, the software is always there. It may be hidden until somebody hits med school, but it was always there because the grades, quote, were good enough, but the effort that was an exhaustion that it required to get to that point. And yes. Then when that medical student maybe gets married, has children, and trying to work and do all of this, it ends up hitting a capacity of exhaustion. And that's where maybe they come around, maybe in that in between, the kids are older and so much going on. And not only do they have to plan their own life. Or the kids get diagnosed.
And then they realize that they've got similar issues.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up doctors, because I work with some doctors too. The Achilles heel for physicians right now and medical professionals is notes. And the electronic medical records was supposed to make all that so much easier, and it is making it so much more difficult for physicians and much more complicated. And how, and the corporatization of medicine is now requiring, you know, speed and completing notes. And I mean, I don't know if this is your experience, but it's really been a challenge for a lot of folks in the medical field, is that they're writing notes and keeping up with notes.
Yeah. You know, I was just sharing that with patient of mine who's a doctor in training. And I said, you know, probably time's going by fast, maybe 15 years ago when the EMR started becoming normal. And I was working as a volunteer on the board for an independent physicians association. And you'd hear about some of these independent practitioners and practices who were like, you know what? We're going to, you know, we had this deadline. If you don't have the, you're going to have to get the EMR and you know, it's, you know, you got a year or 2 years and it's getting closer. And they were doing the old paper chart and they had, and you look at their notes and they were like, terrible. And they said, you know what? I'm quitting medicine. If I have to do this, and it's, and sadly, I think many of, how many of those patients actually had underlying ADHD. I was talking to this doctor in a fellowship training that we mentioned before we went on the air, who's being diagnosed working in a procedure-based topic in medicine, who had, interestingly, improvement. He went in because he had a medical condition called severe obesity, was well over 300 pounds, was on a medicine called phentermine, which is a stimulant, and he lost 50 pounds along with some diet changes with it. And I initially said, oh, did you notice anything else? And he kind of said, oh, no, not really. And then I later said, well, you know, up to about over 40% of people with BMIs over 40 have a ADHD. I'm just curious, did you notice any better executive function? And he's then kind of got this big smile. And he's like, well, I really could get my notes done much more efficiently. I was probably getting through the hospital day better, more effectively. Not that they were causing patient harm, but maybe they don't. They spend an extra hour and a half doing notes when they could have spent that working out or cooking a healthy meal or doing the dishes and all of these other things. So self-care.
I think a lot of adults, they come, they don't work an 8 hour day. It's a 12 hour day to get the 8 hours of work finished and they'll bring it home. I also was thinking that, because I wanted to say that a lot of times, I saw an emergency room physician years ago, and he came in because his wife told him if he didn't come in, he'd be evaluated. She was not going to stick around. And I had a question for him. I said, well, how do you learn all the stuff? Isn't that a lot of journals? I mean, you have to do a lot of reading to know what to do. And, you know, emergency medicine is very, you know, a lot of developments happen there. He says, I'm not a journal quoter, but I know those who are. I said, what? I didn't understand. He says, I can't sit and read those journals, but I know who does. And if I watch the procedure a couple times, I know exactly what to do. He's a bright guy. Once he got on medication, and you know, he was saying, I don't see the problem. I said, well, you're losing money at home. You don't know where your money is. You hire an accountant, get somebody who, that's their job, right? But once he got on medication, he comes back and he says, I didn't realize how much the nurses were doing for me. I realized now they would chase me down to get my signature on this or remember to write this. He had no idea that that was even a problem until it wasn't, right? So but I also want to tell people that it's not what we tell you, a lot of these success kind of stories, right? But I'm reminded that with kids, a lot of times, you know, teachers, well, he's not doing anything. But the kid is trying. He's like a duck going through the water, right? He duck is gliding on the surface, but underneath, his feet are paddling like crazy. But you don't see that over the surface, you know? And so, you know, anybody can have ADHD, right? And you may not be a physician, and you may not be what you might imagine to be a high-powered thing, but, you know, you're a person, you have a home, you're responsible for kids. You know, in ADHD can affect you all the way down to you get your teeth brushed in the morning too. And it can be different for different people, you know, and that's, although I see most people with ADHD, I never get bored with it because everybody's different, you know, everybody's different. So it's always interesting to me how this can affect this person here and what they're struggling with. You have to take it down to that individual level at some point, and you take it down to who your patient is and what they're struggling with and, you know, who they are as a whole person. If ADHD is a part of it for them, that's an important thing to know, an important thing for them to learn about and how it's a part of them.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I want to briefly interrupt the podcast to inform you about the Fibromyalgia Starter Pack, which is now available. If you are new to this podcast, it categorizes the episodes in a way that it's more beneficial for those new to fibromyalgia. You can access the link in the show notes to learn more. When you look at where we're at now with our understanding of ADHD and looking on the positive, where we were, what are some of the positives we have up now? And then the second part is, well, where are maybe some of the struggles? And I say we as in the medical community, you know, health community, in our perceptions and understanding of ADHD, and maybe looking historically when you were early in your career and how that's changed
over time. Years ago, with the history of ADHD, and people should know that, and I refer to Barthley a lot. He had pointed out there are children's books from the 1600s about the fidgety Phil. And if you read this little book about how this kid kept falling away from the table because he was rocking on the back and why couldn't he just sit still, that descriptions of ADHD go way, way back. This is not a creation of the 20th century. It's been there, and they have genetic studies taking ADHD way, way back. And I remember one that the incidence of ADHD seemed to get stronger the further away you were from Africa. It's like people migrated. And in the mountains of South America, there's a group of people who have highly alcohol problems and ADHD problems. It's like the furthest you could get from Africa, there you got big ADHD. So this is not a new thing. And people also know now that it's not behavioral. You know, it's not because of poor parenting. Long time, poor parenting, you know, your kids act like this. You have to be very strict. You have to, you know, strictness, I call it structure. But it's not poor parenting. They, back in, I keep thinking 86 in my mind for some reason. There was the first, I don't know if it was MRI, but brain study that showed parts of the brain that was not as active as they should have been, as active in the normal population. And those were the areas that dealt with self-regulation, right? So if you have a part of the brain that its job is to help inhibit behavior so you're not impulsive, and it's not being so active, you see, have more impulsivity. So over time, people should know the science behind ADHD has advanced tremendously. And there's still advances. There's still things they study about it, you know, on the chromosomal level. It's clear that it's a biological, neurobiological issue. And then this whole part about executive cognitive function has really helped, because it's not just you're inattentive. No, it has to do with how your brain can regulate things. And also we know that, you know, people say, well, everybody's inattentive. Well, at times, right. And so a lot of the forms that we use, and you, like you said before, you get it from the person, the subject, and you get it from other people who know them well, right? Because it's often other people who see those issues. But we know that, I explained it to patients, that everybody is inattentive at times. The question is on that normal curve, you know, most people are average, some below average, some above. But for people with ADHD, it happens much more frequently and becomes more problematic, right? So it's not that it's not a crazy behavior that somebody had. It's what people see as normal behavior, but it definitely happens much more. It's not that regulation. So I think that's important for people to know too, that it can be like other people, except your ability to regulate it is a problem. And also, and I guess it's like with chronic disease too, it's not always glaring, right? So that you can have ADHD, that doesn't mean every single minute of your life, right? And it depends on the environment. So a kid can play video games really well and pay very good attention for hours because it's very reinforcing. They have control over it. Put them in a classroom, it ain't going to work now. Or, you know, all kids get swept up in video games. Kids with ADHD have a lot of problems getting off video games. So it becomes kind of an extent. So, I mean, that's what I would want people to know, is that it is neurobiological, that there are reasons for ADHD. It's a very real disorder. It most studied disorder at this point.
When you have somebody who is an adult and they get a diagnosis, Mindy, what impact does that have when somebody first has that recognition and you get a chance to explain and go over what it is?
Yeah, so we call it relief and grief, right? There's a great deal of relief that, oh, this explains everything. Oh, this makes sense now. Oh, okay. And then the grief is, oh, look at all the wasted time. Look at what I could have done. You know, my life could have been so much different. So, I mean, the diagnosis is very, very impactful. Very often people already have if they're going for a diagnosis, they often have a sense of, you know, things have gone wrong or going wrong, and they're seeking, trying to figure out what it is that feels broken about them. So a lot of times, a lot of folks with ADHD take medication. Their first step is to go to their physician. And if they get on medication, some people, you know, they can figure it out. But I find a lot of people, you know, pills don't teach skills. And so they have the clarity and some of the fog is lifted and they can sort of see the forest for the trees. They still never got the skills how to manage their life in a way that fits, you know, how their brain works. So mm-hmm. It's a journey. It's not a destination. It's like for a lot of people, it's just the beginning of a journey.
And I think for many, when using the education, it's so important as part of why we try to do this podcast. It's a journey as you go through these things, and ups and downs can happen throughout that. I think for many people is, if looking at the impact of medication, is often a sense of what you don't feel. Like, I guess I don't feel overwhelmed. I feel calm. That proclivity to want to just grab food, to self-medicate. I had a patient who is a genius in the world of computers. He has a special skills that Amazon seeks, as it rated him as one of the only people that can do a certain thing. And I, again, like many, see the whole family. And he said, with the medication, now I could sit down in 4 hours and debug this computer program. I would have gotten up at least 15 times and gotten glasses of waters and grabbed some snacks and all of this. And again, now trying to implement following a healthy diet is the next step, because there's other comorbid health issues that go along when you carry extra weight and you start snacking when you have a job that's a computer-based job and you're sitting and then you eat when you're out of boredom. That can make it hard to lose weight.
Yeah. So I had somebody who had sort of the converse reaction, where she went on medication and she's like, it's not working. I'm like, tell me what's going on. She goes, well, you know, she was a student and someone older who went back to school. And she's like, I don't know. I'm just sitting around doing nothing now. I have nothing to do. I'm like, so tell me what's going on. She turns out she got everything done in a timely manner. And then she had all this free time and felt like, now I have nothing to do.
Get a hobby.
Well, one of the questions on evaluation for ADHD, especially in adults, is, do you have a hard time relaxing when you have time to yourself? So the person may be, without being treated, may be sitting on the couch, looking sort of on the outside, similar to the woman who's treated, but inside their brain is overwhelmed and the house isn't clean. And then you're like, well, what about reading a book? What about, well, they've never read books before. That's not even in
never had the time.
Or had the time, or, oh, you know, or yeah. They might be, oh, I got about a bunch of books from book clubs over the years, and they're sitting on the bookshelf where I start it, and then I kind of go to the book club and just listen to other people talk about the book and sort of half read, and now it's right. Like, oh, well, grab those books and tell me, oh, wow, I could sit down and do things.
Well, this person is, you know, was one of those people with their was the duck on the water with their feet going all the time. She was working so hard just to maintain. And I don't think she ever had a chance to sit down to relax because she was always so busy trying to keep up with all the things that were in her way.
I wanted to add, you had asked about what's changed. I think the other thing that's changed, and I attribute the change to CHAD, the organization, is to get the issue of ADHD out there. When we first got involved, when we moved back to Virginia, I would go to a CHAD meeting and there'd be 125 people every month because they had not heard about
like, a local CHAD meeting,
125 people a month. And mostly parents, right? Because your kids were struggling at school and now they're beginning to hear about ADHD because of, I think CHAD's influence. And so people have a much better understanding of it now. And there's still stigma around mental illness and stigma around ADHD. You know, you should, you know, I can do this. Why can't you? Well, I know you can, but you just don't want to, right? And I continue to want to work towards people understanding that, and this is Ross Green's line, a psychologist, that kids do well, they want to do well. Kids do well when they can. And if they're not doing well, there is probably something wrong. You know, every kid wants to do well. Parents will tell me about, I think my kid also has oppositional defiant disorder. In my many years of being a psychologist, have I really seen one kid who truly had ODD? They may have oppositional behaviors. It's not oppositional defiant disorder. And you see it with kids when they get on medication and they're listening, that they do their chores. They need some reminders still. It's not, you know, it's not a wonder drug, but they do stuff and you realize it was an oppositional defiance. They couldn't get themselves to do it at the time it was needed. So I think that's one of the big changes. And there's been a medication shortage for Adderall products. The silver lining on that, as disruptive as it's been to people with ADHD, is that people have heard again about ADHD. Congress is interested in the issue. The Public Policy Committee is meeting with one of the congressional committees about the shortage. There's been a lot said. That's a good thing, you know, just in that people in Congress are understanding that ADHD is a significant health issue.
So, you know, you're asking about what's different now or how things have evolved. We were just at the NAFTA CHAD conference in December, and then we were at APSARD in January. And I see remarkable changes in attendance and who's showing up. At the CHAD conference, when they asked who was new, this was their first conference, well over half the folks in the audience raised their hand. And there is a whole cadre of people who are there who are now influencers. They're on TikTok. They're on Instagram. And because these are the folks showing up at CHAD, they're getting good evidence-based information. So it's not a charlatan kind of thing. They're really showing up and wanting to learn and building and networking with each other. So I think there's a lot of, and there's also a lot of discussion about neurodiversity and integrating ADHD with autism and accepting people's quirks and differences and making it more normalized to have ADHD and autism. At APSARD, what I noticed that's different and that's evolving is the integration of ADHD and sleep studies in geriatrics, in other areas. So it's not just the ADHD researchers in their ADHD hives. They're integrating with other specialties. And the folks that are doing research all around the world has just increased. There's so much more. From the first APSARD conference we went to, I don't know, 10 years ago.
We were one of the first.
One of the first where there was, you know, 100 people.
Maybe 60
people. And really shouldn't count me because I say it's, you know, way above my pay grade. I'm somebody who, you know, you read the introduction and read the conclusion and I'm good. But the amount of research that's going on, the amount of different areas of interest, I think it's really amazing how mainstream ADHD is and is becoming and more normalized as everyday people are talking about it and are informed and educated. So I see really positive movement.
I used to review articles for the Journal of Attention Disorders. And it was interesting. We'd get articles from Japan and Korea, China. I mean, you know, Europe. It really is not a U.S. problem. It is the incidents around the world. It's all the same. You know, different, you know, think about England. You know, they used to talk about the village fool. Well, you know, how often maybe that person was ADHD? I mean, just described in different ways. But every, you know, country, they have issues with ADHD.
It's improving. One of the questions I want to ask is, what kind of new insights or take homes did you get from the recent APSARD conference that we went to? One of the things that I heard, or statements I heard, was we need more democratization of ADHD. And I think that part of can be related to there is a pretty concentrated within mental health and within the medical and concentrated experience working with those who are neurodivergent and ADHD, that a very small percentage still, there's a very small percentage of family practice doctors, even smaller for internists, even in the world of adult psychiatry, still relatively small number of people that are actually working. Now that may be increasing, but it's still not, you know, a lot more room to be growing. I have a pretty large practice of much a higher percentage of patients who have ADHD, and that's because you start seeing families and then you get self-referrals that come in, and I would never have had to be sort of an ADHD expert, because if they would have been equally managed by their own prior doctors, I mean, I think the number of interactions with mental health and medical doctors and community before somebody finally gets diagnosed is often many years, especially in adults, maybe over age 25, 30, who maybe weren't identified when they were younger. But getting back to the APSARD, what were some of the insights or take homes that you got from the most recent conference?
Well, let me say, I mean, specifically to your point, that's all kind of the whole focus of the adult guidelines, because how do you make changes? And if once we have adult guidelines in place that are accepted, and by the way, it's not just CHAD and APSARD working together. CHAD and APSARD has representatives from the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, the American Nurses, you know, Association, family physicians. So we're bringing in these other people because they need to know, they need to approve these guidelines too. And as a group, ADHD needs backing of these people. What do we really want to see happen is to influence medical schools. That, just like you're saying, every physician needs to have a really good understanding of ADHD. It's not that every physician needs to be the expert on ADHD or to be trained as an expert on what to do. But like when I got out of graduate school, I knew enough about what I needed to learn. I knew enough about what I was going to be good at and which things I needed to identify but refer to somebody else. So we want doctors to know enough about ADHD to have that question. I wonder if ADHD is an issue, and to refer them if they don't have that skill themselves. It's the same thing that Chad wants in schools. I'd work a lot with kids in schools, and unfortunately, teacher training is not there. Teachers don't get training in ADHD, or they get 20 minutes. But every single classroom in the United States has at least one or two kids with ADHD. And, you know, and they may be halfway able to handle, but, you know, good teaching of kids with ADHD works for everybody else. But the ADHD kids really need it. So in the same way, we're concerned about teacher training. So we're working on the Department of Education about beginning to gather good statistics about how many kids are getting serviced who have ADHD. Because you can't get teachers trained, just like you can't get medical students trained, unless you can show that this is really a problem. And that's why you need the guidelines. So that's one thing I got from APSARD. How about you?
So I really appreciated in APSARD that there were seminars on older adults. There's research on older adults, that there's research on women. I think not enough, but still that women's experience with ADHD is different. There's hormones. And I think that's a really big mitigating factor into how women cope during the course of a month or as they age. I thought it was interesting that Tony found that cannabis use in teenagers is because they're teenagers. And being medicated for ADHD is important in a lot of years, but a lot of times it's because they're teenagers and they're dysregulated just on a good day. I thought there was a lot of interesting introduction of medication, a lot of discussion about medication because of the shortage, that the prescribers have to be a little bit more
knowledgeable
and have more tools in their toolbox than just an Adderall or a Ritalin product. So as I said, in general,
we're looking at the agenda from Absurd.
In general, as I said, Absurd is really above my pay grade. Some of the best time I had actually was talking with other therapists and coaches about how we're managing our clients or tools and techniques that we're using, and some of that collegiality of being with your peers and talking on a really good level. You know, I sat with a coach and a nurse practitioner and a psychologist, and we all compared, you know, how we're managing and what we're doing. And I think that's really a big value of coming together as professionals.
Looking at the agenda, again, I tend to be more interested in kids, but there was one of the presentations about ADHD and reading disabilities and what I got out from it, because it's already known that people with ADHD tend to have a high rate of other disabilities like a learning disability. And they had really good evidence about reading disabilities in kids with ADHD, and not just the not paying attention, but actual reading disabilities. And to the point that they're saying, you know, for any kid in particular, or as I see adult college students and so on, is that if they have ADHD, high likelihood they have a reading disability, and you should do at least a screening reading test. And if you have somebody with a reading disability, you should think that they may also have ADHD and at least do a screening test, because there's an association, which I think is very important.
There's a lot of comorbid issues that it's worth giving a screening test for, because I think one of the things that you had said, and they had somebody at the conference had said, that BMI, high BMI, is one of the most highly correlated issues with ADHD. So there's a lot of room for integration.
I had a recent patient of mine who I was filling in, and was he being evaluated for back pain? It turned out it was chronic pain. He's kind of had it and had kind of a flare up, and there was no specific injury. Middle-aged man who's been struggling for many years, and turned out he's afraid of driving. He was in a car accident a couple of years ago, and he still is afraid of driving. And then diving deeper on my second visit with him, it came out that he doesn't really read. And I, again, now you have chronic pain and somebody doesn't really read well. He must have some reading. I get a chance to do a detailed evaluation. Yeah. Then you're stacking two factors, you know, up to 70% plus another 70% plus this, plus, you know, I struggled in school and, you know, at age 50 something, has never gotten help. He's got two siblings that I said, well, take this form home. have your siblings who I said, are they involved? Do they care about you? Oh yeah, they know about, can you have them help walk through this with you and then come back and we'll go over this. And if they could come back, but again, that is one of these where, oh, in adulthood that may show up and somebody may not ask an adult. As you know, in our medical record, there's a problem list. He had many, many interactions. Why did it take for me to figure out that he couldn't read? And it's just having this awareness that why did it take for me to ask about attention and focus, even know that he had he said, well, I got a lot of extra help when I was a kid. Well, he had some kind of learning disorder. It's not on the active adult problem list. And often we get into that compartmentalization where it's a chronic pain, and nobody expands out to understand those stories that are a broader context to what's happening in the present.
And I think that that's the whole point of what you're doing is the, you know, looking at all the factors and finding ADHD, you know, has a direct influence on somebody's health and also indirect influences too.
One of the questions I had at one of the sessions was, you know, in medicine, we get screened for depression, and that's a routine. It's a PHQ-9, 2 or 9 questions to screen for that, and it's at least done once a year. And I said, how many people have been quickly overdiagnosed with depression or anxiety and never in maybe had a 10-minute, went through this, that, you know what, let's go on maybe an SSRI and hasn't had a long, detailed discussion yet. We're afraid to even screen for ADHD to recognize and diagnose it. And I think one of the biggest reasons is, well, somebody goes on Prozac or Paxil or Sertraline, whatever. Well, it's not a controlled substance. And, you know, what's the harm versus, ooh, it's a controlled substance. I don't want to get my toes into that water. And they look at it differently. Yet how often did somebody get misdiagnosed? And are we overdiagnosing anxiety and depression when they really had, or overdiagnosing oppositional defiant disorder when?
Well, there's so many overlapping questions, especially on the anxiety scale, that look like ADHD, that ADHD looks like, can look like anxiety or depression.
Yeah. Well, any other last thoughts to the listeners out there who may have it, or for those who are in the medical community, of speaking to them?
So there is a screening device called, a screening tool called ASRS. So if you are interested, it's readily available on the internet. And actually, there's another organization that helps folks with ADHD. It's called ADDA, Attention Deficit Disorder for Adults, and it's add.org. And I just noticed on their front page the other day is the screening tool. If you're curious or if you are interested, take the screen or bring it to your doctor, see what they have to say. And maybe it's not going to diagnose you, but it can indicate whether you should explore it further.
And I'd say the same thing. If you, after having discussion, you wonder about it, to me, there's no harm in getting a good evaluation. And you can go to chad.org, chadd.org, and they have resources there. And it could only be helpful. And to me, it's worth the time to take a look at it. Most people come to me asking about ADHD. People don't show up if they don't have an inkling that it's, you know, something. And I'm going to say, a few years ago, there was a study that was done that people come for an evaluation for ADHD. Just coming is a 95% chance that you do have ADHD because they get it. Maybe that's a little bit different today. I don't know.
It may have taken them 5 years to actually get there.
And most of the people I see, who they really have an inkling. They know enough about it that it makes sense.
I just want to clarify something you said. Chad doesn't have resources for evaluations. Yeah. Chad has resources about ADHD. If you have any questions, if you have any concerns,
yes.
If you want to find support, Chad has the website. Is a great font of information.
Yes. It's information about what a good evaluation would look like and those kinds of things. Yeah.
And I think there's so many strides that we've made in these areas and still more to do. I've had a recent patient of mine who has ADHD, recognizes it in her daughter. Her daughter lives in New York, went through all this self-assessment on her own and recognizing having it, goes to her psychiatrist who's been treating her for anxiety for all these years and says, you know what? I think I have ADHD. And the psychiatrist is like, no, you don't.
And go to a different doctor.
And so that's a challenge where I've often said when I have people who are in sections of the country is you almost have to ahead of time, if it doesn't clearly say that as part of, you know, obviously they know when you're looking at your site, Jeffrey, that you do that. But just say, hey, I'm curious, how many patients does this doctor himself diagnose and himself treat? If they go, no, not that much. I know in my health system, my nurse said, well, there's only like 2 doctors that list ADHD in their profile as what they treat. So I think there's, you know, maybe some more that are doing it, but hopefully more that will get involved. I patient of mine who's in the medical training system in his fellowship. I got diagnosed. I said, hey, I'm just curious, how much training did you get on ADHD? And he smiled and he said, maybe one line in that. So I think there is so much to learn, but yeah. It's so into everything. I did learn in the early 90s the importance of depression and how that's such an impact. And I think that's really well embedded in our understanding, but more to go. And I think when we have people like yourself sharing that you're out there, there are people who are really wanting to help, and that there are more people that are doing a lot of research in this area and helping reduce that stigma. I think the guidelines coming out this year will hopefully help bolster that support and hopefully increase the amount of research that's out there, and as Chad does, increasing that awareness. And again, thank you very much for coming and joining us today on this podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Appreciate it. You two do good work. I like this.
Thank you for all those who are listening throughout the world. And I hope that you have gained some valuable insights on your journey to living better with fibromyalgia and relating overlapping conditions. And until next week, go Fibro. Thank you.